finish your year with your dream kitchen with help from Menards. Clearview Cabinetry offers a selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft close doors and drawers and cabinet accessories to match your unique style. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Clearview Cabinets and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, welcome to the Shut Your Face podcast with your host, me, Bree. I'm super excited you guys are here. Thank you so much for listening to this shit show. This is the second season, and I couldn't be more thankful for all of our guests that took the time to talk to me. It's so freaking cool. Go check us out on Patreon for early access and exclusive content. And then lastly, thank you so much to our sponsors, BMAR Media and Leather and Lights. I kind of happen to know them just a little bit. They're pretty cool. Anyways, let's get on into it, shall we?
Hey there.
Hey, lady. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
You know, I'm 6 feet above ground, so that's better than the other.
Right. Good place to be.
Possibility.
Yeah.
Do what?
I said that's a good place to be, right side of the dirt.
You know? Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so first of all, thank you so much for doing this. I've been bugging you for a minute.
I know. It's my fault. It's been a hot minute since I'm trying to get everything together and the availability and yeah, but I'm happy. I'm happy that we're finally connecting.
No, I mean, it's a good thing for you because you're really, that's what I was getting at, is that you're a really busy lady, and you, just to kind of back up, you reside in Texas, and you do real estate in Texas.
Correct.
Now, you have licensed in other states, though, too.
So, I'm licensed in Missouri, and I'm getting ready to be licensed in both Oklahoma and New Mexico.
Oh, wow. Holy cow.
So, yeah. And we've got a couple of associates and brokers that are already licensed in other states. Like, our actual Texas Ranch Sales as a whole is licensed in several states that kind of surround Texas. Uh-huh. So, yeah, we have a big branch. But me personally, Missouri, New Mexico, and Oklahoma are kind of on my list.
Well, I knew you had gotten Missouri. I mean, like, we're friends on social media or whatever, and I've been following you, and you stay really, really, really busy. So is it that hard to get a license? New Mexico is kind of far from Texas. Do you have to travel over there to do it, or can you do it online? Or
so for the school purpose, yeah, I can do it all online, getting my license. Sometimes in certain states, so a lot of licenses are reciprocal with other states. Texas, unfortunately, is reciprocal with nobody. So we have to meet, yeah, as a broker, every time I take a test, I have to take the schooling, and then I have to take the national and state exam. Some states will give you exemptions on education because Texas is seen as one of the most, the highest education requirement state out there. So Texas is pretty hard, and they make it tough. If you want to get licensed outside, you've got to go through all of the hoops that everybody else does.
I had heard or seen or read somewhere where Texas is kind of up there when it comes to getting your real estate license. Whereas, like here in North Carolina, you literally can get that joker in 6 weeks. It's not as hard, but people say Texas is very hard. What led you to this? What led you to particularly start doing real estate with ranches and kind of the Western ag industry? What led you to where you're at today?
So I have always been involved in real estate. My mom is a real estate agent and has been for years in Arizona and Colorado. And so from the time I was a lot younger, still in high school, college, I worked in a real estate office. for her and with her and did a bunch on property. And I decided to train horses when I got a little bit older and thought that that was going to be my career forever. When I ended up moving to Texas, I realized that East Texas is not really the horse mecca compared to most of Texas. So I quickly decided, you know, what else? I've ridden horses and showed horses for years and years. So what am I going to do next? And my mom called me one day and she said, Jessica, I think you should get your real estate license. You know it well enough. And I kind of laughed and said, no, I don't think it's for me. And here I am. So that kind of pushed me to get my real estate license, and I've been in it forever. And then I've done residential, I've done all aspects of real estate. But, you know, for me, I think the way that I grew up kind of in the ag industry and the horse world, I just land and ranch and horse properties and hunting properties. It's what I do daily. So it just makes sense to me to be in this business. Residential, I've done residential for years and years, and I've been in a couple different residential offices, and you know, it wasn't for me. It's a different world, kind of different mentality, different everything. So the farm and ranch is, that's it for me. It's what I know.
I don't think people, I don't think like your common person, like you just hit on something. I don't think they realize kind of the expertise that, I mean, it's one thing to know real estate and how it works, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but the specialties into certain different things, kind of what it takes. Like if you have not been around horses your whole life, it would make no sense for you to do what you're doing. But the fact that you have really puts a leg up for you.
Yeah, 100%. It's a big difference. And there's a lot of educating that goes into the aspect of what we do on the ranch brokerage side, just outside of your everyday real estate agent that may do some land properties or maybe a farm and ranch here and there, and they kind of get their toes wet. But we do this day in and day out. You definitely have to know the land. You have to know the client. You have to know their needs. And we have such a diverse group of people in Texas Ranch Sales that we have our horse people, we have our cattle people, we have our hunting people, and then we kind of have a group of us that are multiverse in all of it. So it's cool when I have somebody call me and say, hey, Jess, I have this client. They're looking for a horse property. You know, what kind of stalls are these? Or tell me about this equipment that they're looking at or the different types of ground for what their discipline is. It's nice to be able to know that stuff, because I don't think your everyday residential agent is going to, I hate to say that, but it's just facts.
Well, yeah, it's not a dig at them. It just is what it is. Like,
yeah,
you know, can't slap a horse farm in the middle of a neighborhood. So
yeah, exactly. You know, we study and involve ourselves so heavily in this business that we know what we're looking at. And when it comes to, again, all aspects, I mean, we've got guys that can go out on timber property and help you figure out what your timber value is or how much maybe you need to clear cut or so on and so forth. So a lot of guys with forestry degrees, I mean, just a biology degrees, we have a huge, huge variety of that. And I think that ties in well with the knowledge in farm and ranch.
Now, I just want to touch base on your actual horse experience. So you grew up riding and showing and all of that good stuff. What particular discipline did you do, or did you just kind of do all of it, a little bit of all of it?
So being younger, we did a lot of everything. I kind of grew up more, we started with, believe it or not, but Arabians and in the cow, horse, and reining world. And that kind of transferred. I've been kind of grew up around some of the Appaloosas, and then, you know, followed into the quarter horse side of things. So that started it. I've kind of dabbled in the Western pleasure stuff in and out for years. I've shown everything from 4-H kind of level up to NRHA level, NRCHA level. So yeah, that's kind of my history.
I've dabbled. You've done all of it. That's cool though.
Yeah, it's been fun. I love it. There's, you know, now that I don't do it and ride for a bunch of people anymore, since I don't train anymore, and it's been a lot of years, I'm talking like 10 years since I've been in that position, but I get to do it for myself now and enjoy it a little bit more on the other side of it, and that's pretty fun. But I've been out of it for a while, trying to get back into it, need to get back into it.
Well, I mean, I don't think that that kind of knowledge ever really leaves your brain. Like, once you kind of learn something about horses, it never really goes away.
Yeah, for sure.
It's always there.
Yep, agreed.
So what I wanted to ask you, what is – Texas has some pretty big properties, like huge. Like, out there, 50 acres is nothing compared to what 50 acres would be here in North Carolina or in another state. So what's one of the biggest properties you've ever, like, dealt with, like, acreage-wise?
So me, personally, a couple thousand acres. I know within Texas Ranch Sales right now, our biggest property that we have is 87,000 acres.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It's a lot of property. So, and that's kind of down in that southwest Texas area. But it ranges. We've got everything from 5 acres to, you know, the 87,000 and everything in between.
You would need a full-time job just to navigate and keep a border on that, on 87,000 acres.
Can you imagine?
Need a chopper.
Yeah, no kidding. And they have them. I mean, sometimes that's how they have to tour them down and around there.
I was just fixing to say, I feel like I saw a reel of yours in one or something of that nature, because you do have to kind of get into some weird, I mean, it's not like you can just pull up in a cul-de-sac and go, here's your house. You know, you got to get into
exactly.
It like a truck and stuff.
We do. We take, you know, we haul on a lot of these properties. We have our side-by-sides that we take, and some of them are horseback, and some of them are by helicopter. It just kind of depends on the client, depends on the property, the terrain, all those factors. But you definitely get to see property in a totally unique perspective other than pulling up in your car to the front door.
It's I would love that. I'd be all over that. I'd be like, it's going to take me 3 days to show you this property just so I could be in the air.
We were out on a property the other day talking about how lucky we are that seriously, like, this is our job. You know, you're standing in the middle of this ginormous, beautiful property in the middle of nowhere. There's not a sound anywhere. And you're just like, this is really what I get to do day in and day out. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty cool. From the outside looking in, just watching, I think it's really cool. But now, ranch sales and ranches per se, like acreage of that volume and even just the buildings on some of these properties, obviously are, you know, comparison to your average residential. Would you say it was, you know, working in this particular type of field, is it more comparable to commercial real estate? Because, you know, commercial real estate just doesn't turn over as quick as residential does. Do you think ranches are kind of the same way?
No, I think ranch real estate is in its own ballpark. I think you have your residential, your commercial, and then your farm and ranch. And really, a lot of the properties that we do, I mean, it's kind of mixed. Like, you have people that either having this land is a necessity to their business and their industry, such as your cattle guys. You know, you have all your ranchers, you have your ag people, your crop and hay production. And then you have the other side of it where it's a little more luxury, and you have that buyer client that's looking for a fun property, recreational. They want the hunting land or the horse properties. So I think it's a little different. Commercial, there's always a necessity there. There's always a need there. Residential, obviously, kind of always a need. Farm and ranch is a little bit two-sided. So I think it's kind of out there in its own league.
I can see that. I can see what you're saying. I forgot about, like, the hay production and the business side of it, because some of these people, I mean, this is their livelihood. It's not just...
It is. Yeah.
We got a horse to show. This is a whole other...
We have guys...
Now,
I mean... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, we have guys day in and day out that are calling to find that perfect property to run their cows or their hay crop, and we don't do quite as much, but there's still a bunch of farm ground up in the West Texas side of things. So, yeah, they make a living on their property day in and day out.
Yeah, I think your average person forgets that. Sometimes they look at it and they just think, oh, well, it's just all funny. Horses are all fun and games. I mean, like, no, some of this is a business. Like, we have to talk to somebody and they literally have to have horses to maintain their cattle, you know?
Correct. Yep.
Now, you also dabble in honeyland. You brought up honeyland a little bit ago. I've actually even messaged you about honeyland before. The land out there for hunting, you said, is a little different. It doesn't necessarily, like, once people have a lease or they own it, it's not something that comes up on the regular.
Yeah. So it's funny because there's different portions of Texas that have different, I mean, your hunting, the way you look at it is really, it's just different across the board. So South Texas and Central Texas tend to have a lot more of your high fence, your whitetail, your exotics. East Texas, it's hit or miss a little bit. You have a little more public land out here. But typically a lot of these high fence ranches, if they're not bought for personal use, they're business purpose, and that's the hunting side of the industry. You have your full-time hunters, you have your resorts and your lodges that put their guides out there, and they open business to the public to come hunt that property with a guide or a package, or, you know, however they have that detailed. And then you have some low fence places where you can come and hunt. But most of the time, as far as hunting leases out here, when they do come up, they go so fast. There's such a demand for hunting in Texas. I mean, hunting is a very big business industry, and I don't think a lot of people realize that. They see all the glamour and all the fun side of it, but somebody's probably going to correct me for this, but I think the whitetail industry is a $1 billion business that you can look at. So leasing property out here, good properties go for a lot, and they don't come up very often. Most people secure leases for years, and usually they're multi-gun on leases, which, you know, means multi, there's a bunch of people that are in on that lease. But yeah, Texas is definitely different because you have your high fence hunting, your low fence, your business side of it, your public side of land, huge variety on that.
I can definitely see where it's very lucrative. I mean, I know for a fact people here in North Carolina will travel to Kansas, and they'll travel to other places strictly just for a little, just for a little sliver of it to go yeah. hunt it on a weekend or two, and they'll pay yep. good money for it.
Yes, there's the hunting business is, I'm telling you, it's a good business to be in. It takes a lot, but the return side of it is good. We get a lot of business from out of state guys. Because we're able to have those, you know, Texas is one of the few states where you can have the deer breeding business. So you can kind of modify. And,
oh, really?
And edit. Yeah. Yep. And then
oh,
you have
wow.
the exotic
I didn't know that.
Yes. We sure are. So, I mean, that's where you get your big freaks. Your good
right.
deer. Yeah.
Well, that's so, like
a lot of.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, there's a lot on the deer breeding side out here. A lot.
I did not know that.
Yep.
Well, that's just like in, you know, northern New York. I used to have clients in real estate in New York, and he would go hunting upstate all the time. And I'm sitting there thinking, what's in upstate New York? And he's like, are you serious? The deer are insanely huge up there. And
I've heard that.
It is. Like, I've seen pictures, and you're like, you never would think that certain areas would have what they would have. Because, I mean, I knew people hunted in Texas, and I knew it would be a hunting state, but I didn't realize the demand for it was so big out there. Because sometimes you can associate Texas land with being, I guess, too dry, not having as much, you know, borderline almost desert. And so,
yeah.
you know, when you said it was so big, I was like, oh, wow, that's. And you can breed deer. That's crazy.
You can. Yep. You can import and export deer and exotics. And, yeah, it's a very lucrative business for sure.
Now, you hunt, too. Do you hunt everything, or do you just hunt deer?
I do. I hunt everything. Yep. Anything. If there's a season for it, I'm going to be on it for sure.
Are you just strictly gun, or do you do bow and arrow? Do you do
so,
archery?
Yeah, primarily I prefer to shoot my bow. If I can go anywhere, you know, and I have to have options, I'm going to go with my bow every single time. But I do hunt with my rifle as well. But, yeah, bow, archery is my preference 100%.
It's harder to do a bow,
it
I
is.
Believe.
It is, but that's the fun in it. There's a challenge to it, you know, every aspect of it. I mean, there's a challenge with a gun, too, don't get me wrong, but I don't know. With archery, I'm more on the ground. I don't really do a lot of stand hunting, so it's a lot of spot and stalk type of hunts that I prefer to do, and I love the challenge of it. I love that it's something you have to keep up with, you know, just mentally, physically, all the things that go into bow hunting, where I feel with my rifle, I've shot enough and done enough. It's kind of point and shoot at this point.
I tried to pull a bow back once with my ex-husband. He did bow hunting, and I like prefer guns, and I don't really hunt much, but, you know, I love skeet, and I love shooting. I love guns, but not really hunting because I don't have the patience. But he would go hunting, and I tried to pull the bow back once, and I'm like, ah, forget this. This is hard.
Oh, my gosh. Was it set for him?
I don't know what. I don't know anything about bows. I don't know anything about any of that part of it.
Oh,
I mean, if you want to talk about a shotgun, we can take that apart, but bows, I don't know anything about them. But, no, I literally couldn't pull it back, and I'm like, oh, my God, I've never felt so helpless in my life.
Oh, my gosh. Well, if you ever come out this direction, I'll set you up, and we'll get you to pull one back. You'll be hooked.
Right.
I guarantee it.
Like, it can't be that hard. Are you serious?
Yeah. Oh. No, there's poundage on them, and if they're too high, I mean, there's some that I can't pull back, and I'm just like, no, I'm good. I stick to my poundage, and we roll.
Now, obviously you guys get to do feed plots. You get to do all of that kind of stuff, too. I mean, like, it's full-blown. You can do just – how long is your season?
So, gosh, when does – we have, what is it, September to January 2nd, I want to say. Hell, I'd have to look at the dates, honestly.
That's a pretty long time.
It is. And then it goes maybe – no, I'm sorry. It's December – what is it? The end of season is December 7th, and then I think it goes into muzzleloader season. Shit, I'd have to look at the date
right now.
Yeah, that's bad. That's something I should know, and I'm just like, eh. I mean, it's one of those things that you just, okay, season's over, everybody's talking about it, you know. But archery is earlier in the season. I want to say it starts in October, but shit, I probably need to research my own.
It is. No, you are. You're right. It is. Archery is like September, the end of September to November 1st.
Right.
And then general season is November to January.
Yep. And we have different zones. So you have like central zone, north, south zone.
Yeah.
And they're pretty much all the same. There's some that change. And then sometimes we have like duck season. You have your beginning season, and then you kind of have to let up there for a little bit, and then you go back into it. So, yeah, there's different zones that have different times and regulations.
This is snipe hunting. I thought that was a joke. Snipe is not a real thing.
It is.
Is it really?
It really is, yeah. The next time somebody tells you, if you ask you if you want to go out snipe hunting, say, sure. Now, yeah, they are real.
I was always told to say no. Don't let anybody take you snipe hunting.
Yes. So I grew up with the same thing. It was a whole inside joke, and When I learned to Texas, somebody was talking about it, and I was like, you're full of shit, you know? And sure enough, yeah, they're real. Kind of embarrassing, but yes, they're real.
I just read this right now on the website, and I'm like, hold on, are they screwing with us?
They're totally real. And they really have a season.
They really do. They what do you know? You can't believe shit anymore.
Can't believe anything. Anything. Everything we were told is a lie.
this is true, actually. I asked myself the other day, I was like, whose idea was it to slap humans on this earth and ask us to work our whole life just to die? Like, that's dumb.
No shit. I'm right there with you.
What's up with the zebras out there? Like, it's like every time I see a zebra, it's just out here in Texas. Now, they do have a season, though, right? Like, people do hunt them.
They do. So typically, most of your zebras are on these ranches, and they're aesthetically there. But they do have them. They do hunt them, yes, on a lot of ranches. So they're considered kind of a trophy animal. It falls more into your exotic side of the hunting world. But yes, they fall in line with all your exotics.
I feel like that's a controversy because it's like they're borderline. Like, I don't know. I've read so many misconceptions, like different things. I've read people say that they're assholes. You don't want them around. I've read people say that they like them as a pet. I've had see all types of different ways to look at it. And it's just like, okay, well, if you can hunt them, that's, I don't know what I would do.
Well, they are hard to keep. They, you know, I mean, you have like your petting zoo zebras, I feel like, and then you have the hunting side of the world where these animals are just as wild as you would see them running across Africa, let's say. They, you know, they don't see fences. They don't see anything standing in front of them. So you think horses are really built on flight or fight mode? Zebras are like that times 5,000.
Wow.
And they're very, very territorial and very aggressive.
I read that somewhere that they were aggressive. Like they were really aggressive.
Yep. They can be. Not a lot of people want to mess with them, but you know, they're all kind of their own. So the ones that get a little more domesticated or probably have a different little brain on them or something. I don't know. Zebras are interesting. You can, sometimes you go out on these properties and there's certain animals you just really watch out for, and they're damn sure one of them.
Well, that leads me to the alligator. That freaking alligator that you got was huge.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. So
where, I mean, alligators in Texas don't go hand in hand. I don't.
Oh, my gosh. We have so many alligators. Up where I live in the east part of Texas, we have a lot of swampland, and so we have a ton of alligators. Sometimes we go out bow fishing, and they're swimming next to the boat waiting for all the little fish to pop up. We have tons of them, and we have tons of them down around Houston area, Beaumont, kind of down in the Bay area. We have tons of them, and we actually have a guy that works for us, Damian Hubbs. He outfits, and the landowners out here will get a certain number of gator tags every year because they're such a nuisance, or can be, to livestock, dogs, so on and so forth.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, so he had two tags, and it was towards the end of season, and I had wanted to do it for a really long time, and I kind of laughed, and he had two that just happened to pop up, and I was like, you know what, throw me in. And so ran down there that morning, and we went out. They put us on the whole season. They had got, no, I don't want to say small gators, but they were averaging 6 to 7 foot. And we pulled up on that sucker. He was 15. Shoot, I don't even remember. He was over 15 foot.
I'm looking I'm on your page now looking for I distinctly remember. There it is, right here. Yeah. Oh, my God.
He was so big. And I remember, so I've never done a gator hunt before. And so pulling up on him, and he was baited. He was on a line. And we, you know, Ryan, the guy that was with us, he pulled him up. And I have never seen something so prehistorically freaky in my life. I mean, the way that that guy's head came up out of the water was just intimidating for sure. But, pulled him up and did our thing, got him in the boat, and he was cool. Man, that whole thing was cool. I'm going to go this year again, too. I'm excited.
It's got to be at least, at minimum, if you're 5'9", let's say we'll give you 6 feet. It's got to be at least two of you hanging down right there, at least 12 feet long.
I think he measured 15.2 or 3 foot.
Jesus Christ.
15 point something. He was the biggest one they had pulled out or got the whole season. And then I got a 6.2 foot gator also.
Yeah, you're holding that one.
Yeah, I'm holding that one. And then I think I put a picture too where the 6 foot one is in the 15 footer's mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he just looked like a little squeaker toy. I mean, yeah.
I'm looking at it now. It looks like, it's like you're just holding like, you know, you wouldn't think that one would be 6 feet long.
I'm 5'3". I'm 5'3", so that puts it in perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big freaking gator.
Yeah, he's a monster. So I had him taxidermied. I'm keeping his hide.
Cool.
I have no idea where I'm going to put him, but I did a full taxidermy on his head. I'm pretty excited to get that back.
Oh, wow, that is going to be cool. And you've got the rest of his body, is it skin? You call it skin? This is skin? I mean, what would you call it?
His hide.
Right. What are you going to do with it? You don't know.
I don't know. I've seen a couple people that have made some really badass boots out of their gaiters. I've got some buddies that do really good leather work that have offered to make some belts and stuff. And so I have no idea. Or I'm just going to keep them and hang them on a wall somewhere, all 15 foot of them.
That is pretty cool. I was fixing to say, I saw, like, where people have bags made, but you lose so much. Like, you know, you don't want to...
I think I'm going to leave the six-footer for the one to let people cut up and do whatever with.
Yeah. Yeah. God, that was so freaking cool. I remember that post, and I was like, holy crap, that thing is huge. I didn't even know they had them in Texas. Like,
yes, we do. I want to say state record was 18 foot, maybe. That's pretty damn big gator.
That is huge. Yes, that's huge. And
yeah,
they're not, I ran across a TikTok on a girl that does, like, photography in the Everglades or whatever, and she's, like, real informative about the gators there. She's literally, you see all these TikToks of her swimming around them like it's nothing. And she said,
yeah,
one of the things about the gators down there was that they're fed so much and they're around people so much that,
yeah,
they're not as big of a threat as people assume them to be. But I would think maybe in Texas, those gators don't get to see people as much, so that's probably why they are such a nuisance.
I think it kind of depends. So, like, what's funny is there's a lot of people, I didn't grow up in East Texas, and all the people that did grow up here, they swim with them. I mean, they're in the river, they're in the lakes with them. They're not bothered or fazed by them one bit. Me, on the other hand, I'm a little more skeptical. But I guess it's just kind of like, I don't, same with the water snakes. I mean, they just swim, they're just a part of the water and they respect that. And, but a lot of these, yeah, they see a lot of people, a lot of them that are in our state parks or on private property, you know, they're greeted daily by some of these guys out there that are working cows and they run across them or dogs. So I don't know. You don't have a lot of gator incidents in Texas, or not that you hear about.
Well, I think they're,
I want to say they're pretty, I don't know, they're used to people. They're acclimated. I think you hear more horror stories with hogs and people than you do gators.
Well, that was my next question, was them wild pigs out there are crazy.
They are. Yep. They're, yeah. They're fun to hunt, though.
Well, I don't know much about it, but so I did see a couple of posts and videos that kind of correlate to hunting pigs out there and wild hogs out there. People will pay to go hunt wild hogs out there.
That's
correct.
Yep. They pay big
Why
money
is it
to
so
come
fun?
In from out of state. Man, it's just fun. You can hunt pigs in so many different ways. I mean, they've got, I think the bigger money spent on hog hunting is your helicopter hog hunts. They will take you up and you come out, they are gun ready. They supply you with everything. You get on a helicopter, they go out, they fly over, they will bring up a ton of pigs just from, you know, pigs kind of panic when they hear that helicopter come in, and you just start blasting from the sky. It's pretty wild. And then you can hunt them with dogs out here. You can run them. You can spear hunt if you want to. You can take a pig, however, by any means necessary. So it's attracting. It's appealing. And when you go out on a ton, hundreds of acres, and you just start blasting, these little pigs start running thermal. You can. It's fun. It's a good time.
I would have so much fun. You have no idea.
Yeah, and we have a lot of hog hunts out here too, where people, you know, there's like hog competitions, and people will get in their groups of four, their teams of four, and they go out and whoever pulls. I mean, there's good money in it for sure. Some of these guys can make a pretty little penny just hunting pigs at night. So
they have competitions and they get teams together to go hunting, and how many
they
to go hunt, how many pigs they can pull, who pulls the most pigs.
Yeah, sometimes it's by weight, sometimes it's by numbers. Typically, I think they do it by weight. Whoever brings in the, you know, like the highest weighted pig or pigs. It just depends. They're all the competitions are super different.
I didn't know they had these competitions for the pigs.
Yeah, It's pretty funny. We're overrun with pigs. I mean, I was talking to somebody else this morning, and they even didn't understand the hog problem that Texas has. So,
I mean, like, we're sitting here saying that it's just for fun. It's actually for a pro. Like, they are a problem, though, actually, because
they
mean,
are a problem.
Yeah, because they just kind of run. It's overpopulated, and that's why you gotta do it.
Yeah, they can come in and tear up your hay field. I mean, so many acres within a couple hours at night. Just 15 or less hogs. I mean, the damage that they can do is insane. And when they tear up your ground, I mean, it takes every bit of having to go back out there and reseed, take a tractor, smooth it out, get it back to workable ground. The hogs destroy crop. They destroy a lot of things.
Yeah, so, that's what I read. That there's, I mean, the reason why they do it is to help in some way, shape, or form.
Yes. Yes.
So let me ask you this about particularly being in real estate. So it's not like, you know, maybe you do sell a property a day. I don't know. But it's always hard for real estate because it fluctuates on when you sell things and don't sell things. You have higher peak times throughout the year and slower times and stuff. Was that something that you kind of had to, like, get used to before you got into the business, or it was just something you were already used to and, you know, were able to kind of plan around?
Yeah, so having a background in real estate, I think, really helped me understand that this is commission-based and it's kind of feast or famine business. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of people, and I hate to say it, but during even the COVID times, so many people just saw that real estate boom and thought, oh, my gosh, I'm going to get my license. It's so easy to do this. I can become, you know, I can make millions. I can get in and make all this money, and this is the most simple thing. And, I mean, a lot of that's fallen off because there is a lot of competition in real estate, and if you have to go in prepared. I mean, most of our properties can sit on the market for 6 months to a year is very normal. A year to 2 years is normal, where when you look at residential, when you get to 30 days or 60 days on the market, you're stressing because that property should have been sold. Why hasn't it sold? Where, you know, on the ranch side, you have to be prepared. And I think a lot of people getting into the ranch real estate don't understand. You can go a year without a paycheck easily. So you have to really come into this business and be prepared to set yourself up where whatever you're doing, there's going to be something productive of it that comes in 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. So what am I doing today that's going to benefit me, you know, to get a paycheck in 30 days or 20 days or whatever? So for me, going into that and kind of having that background of seeing how it all works, hell, I saw my mom struggle. She was in real estate in 2008 when it completely crashed and bottomed out, and she never quit. She never stopped, and I think real estate is that way 24/7, all the time, all day, every day. The second you stop or kick back and think, hey, I can relax, you know, I just got a great paycheck. I'm going to kick back and relax for a little bit. You're going to sink, man. It's going to hurt, and you're going to feel it when that next time frame comes around. So for me, I'm always trying to stay one step ahead. Every day I put work out there and I do work, and I know that, you know, tomorrow it might not be rewarded, but 30 days from now I'm going to have something that I effectively planned and we nailed it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I remember that boom. I remember because I did real estate graphics. I wasn't in real estate, but we did real estate graphics. I told you how we did real estate for the real estate book that's when you used to actually market homes. And you're right. Some people will just look and go, oh, they'll underestimate the work is what they'll do. They'll underestimate what it takes to get to a certain level in real estate. And through that boom, your OGs that had been in it were the ones to survive. And all those new agents that come up on the front swing, they kind of bailed out because it happens. But that could be scary.
Yeah, it is scary. I mean, you every day you have to have a really good support system. And you know, the other day the gentleman that owns Texas Ranch Sales, Sheldon, him and I were talking, and we were having a really good conversation because I have a team under me. And you know, one of the things he brought up is there's a lot of positives in being in real estate, but something that people don't really realize is how well, as a real estate agent or broker even, can you manage your money to make sure that you can survive in this world personally and you can survive in this world on the business aspect? So I think in being very successful in real estate is how well you manage your money. If you get a paycheck, where does that paycheck go? Are you going to take it and say, hey, I want all the pretty fancy things because I can right now? Or are you going to put that money aside into an account and pay yourself and do it smart? So when things pop up, you can say, hey, I'd love to put my marketing funds there. And I think that's a big part of being very successful in this business is how you manage your money and what you do with it. And that's going to help you survive to that next paycheck. And it makes you a little more comfortable in real estate. Because let me tell you, when I first started, I was like, every commission was, I needed every penny of it, you know, just to help me get to the next one. And there were times where, I mean, hell, when I started, I have no shame in saying I would call my parents and say, look, I'm struggling. I'm hurting over here. Something was supposed to close and it fell out or didn't close, and you just can't bank on those paychecks. So money management is a big deal in your success in this business, for sure.
Yeah, and it costs you guys a lot. I don't think people realize. Sometimes I think there's a disconnect between the real estate occupation in general and, you know, your other average person. It costs money to market. It costs money to buy the things to market. It costs money to do the photos, to do this, to do all that stuff. Like, all the money that goes into it, people think that some people just think it just comes out of thin air, and that's, like, yeah, not a part of the commission. Like, you know, y'all don't get all of that big check. A lot of that check's spent before you even get it.
100%, yeah. Yep. And especially with what we do, the amount that we put into our marketing and advertising and individually for every single property that we get, it's big. I mean, it's a substantial bill, and a lot of people don't see that side of it.
Mm-mm. No, they don't. Now, I wanted to ask you about as far as land, okay, we talked about honeyland, then we talked about ranch land and ag. You also do, like, for crop production and land that's basically people will buy for, you know, soybeans and corn or whatever have you and stuff. Do you dabble into that type of land as well?
I do. So probably a little bit less than some others. Texas is not an entire crop state, I guess you could say. We have North Texas kind of up in the Panhandle area, some places in Central Texas, and then down in parts of Central South Texas, I think you have a lot more different. I mean, we have a variety of things. We have pecans, we have cotton, we have peanuts, then you have all your hay production every which direction.
Wait, is it pecans or pecans?
That's a hot topic. So in Texas, we're going to call it pecans. I know for you guys, you call them pecans. But yeah, no, definitely pecans.
I've never heard it called pecans.
It is.
I love that
pecans.
Though.
What?
I love that though. I love, like, the way that people. I love the different way to say things. Just like tomato,
all the different dialects.
Or salmon, oh. Or what's, how do you do salmon has two ways too. It's like salmon or salmon. And somebody told me they're like, there's no ale in it. And I'm like, okay, well.
I have a habit of a lot of words that I say, I add there's like a draw. I add L's to places that shouldn't be there. But yeah, we have, I have a lot of different brokers and people that I talk to that are kind of a little bit more from the South, and they call it pecan. come on, man. When I say pecan, I'm like, that just sounds so weird. It sounds foul.
When you compare it to the way you say it, it's like, oh.
Yeah, like I'm over here eating my pecans or what? No, man. You just say you're eating pecans.
I didn't know y'all had pecans.
See, you want to say it correct now.
I want to say pecan, but I'm trying not to. Okay, y'all have pecans. I didn't even know y'all had those out there. That's crazy.
We do. Yeah, we're a huge producer in them, actually. cotton, peanuts, I mean, all of it. But we have a lot of farmland. Yeah.
Somebody has to buy and sell that. Like, I mean, somebody has to have that stuff available. You think, I mean, it's just like, you know, you go about everyday life and you don't think about the things that are considered everyday life for other people. Just like, you know, cropland in its essence for whatever people are growing. But you do, guys do have that out there and you do have to deal with it, which is a whole nother different ball game.
It is, yeah. We have olive orchards. I mean, for all, like, people that grow olives and extract them for olive oil, which is a huge, I had never really dived into that until, or dove into that, whatever. Probably about a year ago, I got a call to list a olive orchard, and I was like, I don't know a thing about olives, but I guess I'm fixing to learn. And it was great. It was a good learning experience. I mean, going into the nursery side of things and realizing what it takes to have these and that there's such a big demand in production in Texas and kind of where it goes, imports, exports. I learned a ton about olive oil, and that's kind of cool. It's not something you think you're just going to wake up every day and dive into. So,
right.
Yeah, if you don't know, you're going to get educated quick, or you're going to have to get educated quick on the different crops and nurseries and farming and planting and crops and all the things. So.
How would you even begin to start trying to price that and value that? Oh, my gosh.
Oh, it's a process. There's so much that goes into it. I mean, down to each tree, type of trees, the production, there's the business side of it where you can look at all the profit and loss. You know, you have your P&Ls, you have your business projections. You have to factor in all of that when you're pricing those types of properties. There's a lot.
I didn't know
that. Yeah. You have to deep dive equipment, what it comes, the money potentially coming, you know, in for the next purchaser kind of factors in. There's so much that goes into it for sure.
Yeah, no, I didn't. You just, there was a light bulb that went on. I had no idea that you would actually have to look at the business aspect of something like that. But, I mean, that's common sense now that you say it. If you're somebody's going to sell an orchard we're not growing olives for the hell of it. You know,
yeah.
For a business part of it, you're going to have to dabble into the business documents of things. I that just, like, my light bulb just went off in my head. Like, oh, wow, I didn't think about that at all because you – there wouldn't be a way to separate that out. You would have to look at it as a business it would be a business deal, not a real estate deal, or would it?
It's a little bit of both. Yeah. You kind of dabble on both aspects. Yep. So, and I guess that's where some of the commercial side of things can kind of come into the farm and ranch side, and where it can, you do deal with a lot of commercial business in farm and ranch sales, I guess. But yeah. We look at you know, we do have several type of businesses for sale. We're selling the property, of course, but with that does go the transfer of business, and you have to calculate all the factors that make that business happen and work and projections and be able to have understanding of all of it, plus sit down with those clients and explain, you know, kind of help guide them through that. So I think that's another kind of aspect of our industry is not only do we look at the real estate side of things, we understand the agricultural loans, but we also understand the small business loans that people will look out to buy some of these farm and ranch properties or businesses or whatever the case may be. There's a power is knowledge in a lot of that, and you definitely have, it's a specialty industry for sure.
How cool is that you could wake up one day and learn about olives? And I mean, like, you know, I'm just saying, like, not that you would wake up and that's your dream, but how cool is that to know that? Because, you know, you just don't think about this stuff.
You don't. And it's funny, but, you know, in my real estate career, I'd never talked about an olive orchard a day in my life. Never had a call, never had a conversation, never a thought in my mind. And what's funny is that when I had that listening and I got educated really quick, and I appreciate that education because it's funny how I've had so many different conversations about that property. I've had appraisers call me with questions on other olive orchards that they were selling, and it's cool to be able to educate and learn with each other, but it's funny how things kind of, when they gravitate towards you, how they go out in the universe. I was at an event one time and a lady approached me and she goes, oh my gosh, I follow you. I see that you had this olive listing for this olive orchard. And she's like, you know, we have an olive orchard and we'd love you to take a look at it and kind of give us your opinion and pricing. And obviously, you know that. And I never in a million years would have thought somebody at random would approach me and I would be able to have such a detailed conversation over olives and olive oil.
So, but, I mean, how cool is that, though? Seriously, that is really cool.
Yeah, it keeps you on your game, and you're constantly learning. I mean, you're constantly learning. So
well,
I think
mean, your average person just wouldn't sit here and think, okay, well, that's going to need X amount of knowledge in order to do that. And then now you're talking, like, we're sitting here talking about it now, and you're like, oh, wow, you would have to take a day or two to dive into all of this extra information that you normally wouldn't need in order
totally.
To do your job. And I don't think people think, give real estate agents enough credit for having to do some of that stuff.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, for me to be able to sell that property, I had to understand not just the dirt that this property existed on, but the business side of it. So I had to kind of dive into the different types of trees, types of olive oil, different percentages. I mean, all the soil that samples and things that go into it, all the analytical side of those soils, you know, I have to know all of that to have that conversation to sell that property. If somebody were to call me and ask if, you know, these trees produce a certain type of olive oil and at what percentage, and I said, well, I don't know, that doesn't sound, I'm not selling my product very well. Even though I don't sell olive oil, I need to know how to have those conversations about that specific property. So you do, there's a lot that goes into it other than just, hey, I'm going to list your place and put a sign on the ground, take calls, answer them best I can, and push it on down the road.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's a lot.
Now, I also wanted to kind of ask you, you still have horses now. You have horses that you have. Do you just keep them for leisure, or do you have any, like, aspirations to show, or do you show now? And if you do, you know, what type of goals do you have with that, or do you have any – or is work keeping you way too busy?
So work keeps me pretty busy. And it's funny, but I was just talking to one of my really good clients this weekend. I was at her property, and they're big in the cow horse stuff. And we were talking about how sometimes it's so hard to get motivated to go ride. You know, at the end of the day, you're just kind of tired. And so right now, I do. Work is my focus. My poor little mare, she's been on the back burner. She's there when I need her, and I can get her. I can hop on her and go do whatever. I'm not showing at the moment, but my plan, I kind of started looking last year, and I'm looking slow, and I believe timing is everything. When it's right, it's meant to be, it'll happen. But my goal is to definitely get back in the show pen and get back to just hauling and blowing and going when I can, you know, obviously when I can. But,
right.
Yeah. Right now, my little mare, we just kind of toot around and I can practice on her and do all the things I need to, and I would love to show her. I just, that takes a lot of time, and she'd probably benefit more if I just sent her on down the road and put her in a barn with somebody and, you know, kind of went from there. But by now, she's perfect for what I need and when I need her, and, yeah, hopefully this year or next year I'll be back in the show pen. Kind of my plan.
A lot of people do. I think it's healthy, like mentally, for your mental health, like to get take a break from showing and like step away from it for a certain amount of time.
Oh, 100%.
And you'll hear people, yeah, they'll like step out and then they'll come back for a little bit, and then they'll step back out, because it can be like, it can be teeth grinding to be up in it.
I love the horse world. I mean, that's my world. But let me tell you, Netflix would benefit from a huge documentary on some of it.
Right, right.
Crazy.
Yeah, no, I mean, but it's nice to be able to just enjoy the horse in it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think I've been on vacation from it for a really long time, and I'm finally kind of at a point in my life where I can get back into it and really just have fun with it and not be caught up in the chaos of it all, but say, hey, this show looks fun, or, you know, hey, I want to go ride with so-and-so this weekend, and I'm going to load up and go do that, or just get back and enjoy it. I think that's the biggest thing. Sometimes you can get so caught up in it that it becomes a chore almost.
Right.
But, yeah, I've been out. I'm ready to get back in it. I know I have that itch, you know?
Yeah.
Especially I go to some of these horse sales. Yes, some of these horse sales, and I'm like, oh, shit, should have bid on that one. But timing is everything, man.
Well, that's I was just talking about the this next episode that's coming out. Was talking to her about how, you know, there's not really a handbook to help you price horses, and it has been. It's almost, I feel like the horse sales industry has kind of been like what real estate was back in 06, 07, 08. It did this huge rise, and you were almost looking at everybody like, okay, you got a 430 Beacon and you live in a $150,000 house. Something right.
Yes. Yes. So much. The horse market's crazy.
Yeah, but I think it's coming back down some. Do you not think so? Do you think the prices are coming back down to, like, normal area, or do you think it's just going to stay – do you think it's going to stay up to a certain percentage forever? Do you think it's forever changed?
No, I think – you know, I don't know. I think it's – I don't think it's the price – the horse market's ever really balanced. I think we're just – I think it's kind of running steady over the last year. I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's all over the place, and that's the problem with it. There's no regulation in horse sales. So
yeah,
it's everywhere. I see horses every other day that are going for a couple hundred thousand or a couple million, and then you see some that are going for 7,500, and you're like, where is the disconnect here? You know?
Exactly.
yeah, and I mean, no discredit to some of those ones going for 7,500 or whatever. I mean, they're a clean bill of health and all the things, but they're out there. But I think a lot of these horse sales that have come up, you know, buying a horse is so different than what it used to be. You used to say, hey, yeah, I'm interested in this horse. You'd show up, you'd see it, you'd try it out. We kind of hardly live in those days anymore with some of these online sales, and I think they're wonderful. You can look at videos, you can look at x-rays, you can look at all the vet stuff that goes along with it. But with that comes more competition. It's easier to drive some things up. You have the luxury of buying a horse from your home. So you can put some of those fees on traveling and all the different things that go into buying a horse. You can put that into the horse now. So I don't know. I think that has really changed the market, changed the game. And I think it's been a long time coming for the horse world. I think you're seeing things now that, I mean, the horse world has been stagnant for years. Nothing changes.
True.
And I think we're starting to see that market change. And, I mean, hell, I look at it with farriers. I think farriers are behind the times on what they charge. And there's so many people that would shoot me for saying that. But, I mean, you have guys out there still charging, you know, $120 to shoe a horse, and that's crazy to me. I'm like, you guys are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for horses, and we're paying these guys nothing. So
you are right, though. And for the work, yeah, for the work that they do, like with what their bodies go through as a farrier,
oh, dude. I hate it. It's so bare minimum. But the sad thing is it's like, you know, if they charge more, of course, their good clients are going to stay, right? But it's easy for somebody to say, hey, I'll go hire whatever backyard ass person wants to come shoe my horse or trim my horse. I mean, people, they don't care. So I think that's another industry that's really hard to get up, but it's behind the time. It needs to come. I think it's coming. I know a lot of different farriers that, you know, they charge a good dollar for what they're worth. But I think the more we see the horse world evolve, between the sales and the breeding and the showing aspect, you're showing there's a lot bigger pool of money in these horse shows anymore than there used to be. There's more incentive. And so I think it's slowly coming for each little part of the industry, but there's no regulations. It's all over the place.
It is. That's what we were talking about. It's not like in real estate, you can at least have like a system in place to help you price things. Given it's not like some crazy specialty thing, like an olive orchard, you know, like,
yeah,
it's
for sure.
Out there.
And but, even on, you know, a lot of these big, crazy properties, we rely so heavily on appraisals and fair market value and kind of what is going across the board. So we have limitations on that. And, of course, you're always going to get some of your cash people that can pay over what it's worth, and that's very subjective, you know. The price, and it's kind of like that with the horses, I guess. People will pay whatever they feel that sucker is worth.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we said. Basically, yeah, a horse is what somebody's willing to pay for it.
Yeah, 100%. So real estate can be a little bit that way. It's just you don't see it quite as often as you do with the horses. We definitely have the appraisal system, and I know there's appraisals on horses too and stuff. I just don't think it's a standard, thing that people heavily rely on like we do in real estate. Definitely different.
Now, you're a team lead. You have people under you, and then you have, the guy that owns it or whatever above you, but you're a team. You have a team underneath you. Are you building a team in the other states? You're going to have people underneath you over there too, or is it just going to – do you go there first and then build over there?
So my plan right now, I just have people in Texas under me. The out-of-state, it requires a lot to have – team and a team and be responsible for other bodies. I mean, it's a lot. So right now Texas is the only place I want to have a team and build a team. I love my team. I want to keep it there. New Mexico, Missouri, and Oklahoma, I'll probably just work those myself and do the listing side of property and help if we have a buyer client that's looking to sell their place, a buyer here in Texas that wants to sell their place in these other states, we want to be able to accommodate that. So yeah, just the team here in Texas for now.
Yeah, because don't you have to have certain – I think you have to, be a level for X amount of time before you can go up to a new level. I think that's what it was for North Carolina. Like, you have to be – you can't be a broker until you've done so much elk here, et cetera, et cetera. You can't just jump around. You have to work. You have to earn it.
In Texas, to be a broker, you have to have so many years under your belt, so much education, and then so many transactions. It's high up there. And then you have to take a test to further, show that you're worthy of holding that broker's license. It's a whole process. So a lot of people go years having their real estate license, but they don't have the education. And so they, in order to get that broker license, you have to catch up on 600 and some odd hours of education when your standard every year is maybe a couple hours for continued education. So there are different tiers of being agent, associate, broker associate, and so on and so forth.
Well, congratulations to you. You're obviously doing something right.
Thank you.
Killing it.
I try.